May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Garber has raised a number of issues before the court for your consideration. I wish to address three of those issues here this morning. I will attempt to reserve approximately 1 minute of my time for any rebuttal argument. The three issues that I would ask the court to focus on in assessment of Mr. Garber's case are the due process issue pertaining to the court's failure to abide by the terms of the plea agreement, particularly the failure to employ the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Let's go through the words of the plea agreement and tell me exactly what violations there are.
The plea agreement in its entirety was framed in light of the existent law at the time.
I'm having a little trouble here figuring out what document is determinative, because you have one thing that's signed by everybody, and then you've got a subsequent thing that's just signed by defense counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. This was a global settlement. The settlement involved litigation activity at both
global,
federal,
state as well as federal.
State as well as federal. The practice, perform before the court in terms of a settlement where we have a global settlement. All documentation pertaining to the settlement are placed before the court. The document that is signed by all the parties, the government, counsel, myself, Mr. Garber, that is the primary federal settlement agreement to which I refer in these proceedings.
So you're looking at ER 15, paragraph 16, correct?
ER 15, paragraph 16, that is correct, Judge, and as well, paragraph 3 at ER 13, where the parties specified their employment of the sentencing guidelines text, the November 1, 2003 edition. I'm also pointing to the fact that in the course of the court's colloquy with Mr. Garber, in taking the plea, the court agreed to and accepted the terms of the plea agreement, and in fact acknowledged where I said to the judge, and you will find this at ER 40, where I said to the judge, Judge, we reserve the entitlement to have the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard applied to sentencing enhancements.
What page are you talking about?
I'm talking about ER 40. That's excerpt of record 40. It would be page 21 of the plea colloquy transcript.
Okay.
And if you look there, Judge.
Let me ask you a question about those two things. Usually in the federal language, you have an 11E1A, an 11E1B, or an 11E1C. An 11E1C says to the judge, either you do what this agreement says, or the defendant can withdraw his plea. An 11E1B says the prosecutor and the defense agree that the prosecutor will make the following recommendations, but the sentence is up to the judge. Now, this does not use express E1B or E1C language. Since it does not use express 11E1C language, my thought was the judge reads it, the judge understands that these are the intentions of the party, but the judge nevertheless applies what, in his judgment, is the law. Why isn't that the correct reading?
I would say that's not the correct reading for the following reason. In the reality of real practice in the district court level, you do have the 11.
I was a district judge. That was my practice.
Right.
My
well, right. Right, Judge. But in the context there, if you come with an 11, whatever it was, E1C, I think even the numerals have changed now. But if you come with 11C agreement, you've got a specified result. You're telling the judge, here's the result the parties have agreed to. This is what we've agreed to. If you're going to accept the terms of the plea agreement, impose judgment, and sentence, you have to abide by that agreement. In 11C1B, you're coming before the court and you're saying, Judge, these are the recommendations of the parties with respect to what we think ultimately, as has been the practice for 17 years, the sentencing guidelines computations will be. We understand, Judge, that you can, in fact, ignore our recommendations with respect to the application of particular guidelines provisions.
Yeah, I'm thinking this is like the latter. I mean, you tell the judge, here's the standard of proof for you to apply, and the judge says, well, I hear you, but that's not right. That's not the law.
But that's not what the judge said, and it's different from the situation where you come before the court and you're acknowledging these are recommendations. as distinct from where you come before the court, and we were in a period of transition, and that has to be acknowledged, back in the fall, I guess it was, of 2004. We were in a period of transition, but we came before the court with a complicated, complex agreement that specified in a number of provisions, and again, during the course of the allocution.
Counsel, I want to ask you about paragraph 14, because that seems to me to be important, at least in my thinking. It says, the defendant understands that sentencing rests within the sole discretion of the court, who is not bound by the party's recommendations. And it goes on to say, you might not, if you get more, you can't undo this agreement. So he knew going in that he might get a longer sentence and that the court might disagree with paragraph 7, wherein the parties agree that there aren't any applicable enhancements. So why doesn't that undermine your argument?
It doesn't undermine the argument because it doesn't address the constitutional rights that Mr. Garver gave up, which the government and the court acknowledged that he was surrendering.
But he has no constitutional right to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard for an enhancement. He just has what was, for a time, some people's inference from Blakely about what his right under the guidelines might be, but it was mistaken.
And, well, if there's a real question, I think, whether it was mistaken, because one can, in fact, view what happens in Booker, which is my ex post facto argument, as, in fact, changing the whole playing field, if you will, in terms of the application of the law. And I do want to address that, but let me just talk about Mr. Garver and his entitlement and rights at the time. In this circuit, at that point in time, Ameline controlled. The parties had come together in light of Ameline and in light of prevailing law, and they said to the court, we're willing to enter a plea agreement to change our plea. We're going to do it within the context of the applicable law. Here's what Mr. Garver is willing to surrender, his right to an adjudication by a jury with respect to sentencing entitlements. That was the law at that point in time. As a matter of not necessarily a Sixth Amendment right, but a due process right, a due process entitlement to the application of the law. We're giving that up, but we are reserving, under applicable law, the entitlement to have any enhancement proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, if it went the other way, the contract couldn't possibly be binding. In other words, if the parties agreed that something had to be proved only by a preponderance, but yet the law was that it had to be beyond a reasonable doubt, there'd be no possibility that the party's contract would trump the requirement of the law. But why doesn't it work both ways?
It doesn't work both ways here because at the time this agreement was executed before the court and accepted by the court, that is the key. And I apologize for the late provision to you under the 28J letter of the Seventh Circuit's I think it's a very right decision. But there, the Seventh Circuit recognized that when you have a contract and you have an agreement and it is accepted by the court is obliged to follow it, and the court is obliged to follow it on the basis of long-standing, well-recognized Fifth Amendment due process considerations that inform the change of plea process. And that is why it doesn't go back, because here the parties, in under usual circumstances, had an agreement, the court accepted the agreement, and then changed with a change in the law. But that change in the law in Booker...
What are you claiming you're entitled to receive? If we were to agree with your comments and your argument, what would happen? Would the trial judge then have to look at the materials, the unobjected to materials in the pre-sentencing report, and say, well, now I find beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim was vulnerable and I'm still going to apply this? I mean, what benefit is there?
There's tremendous benefit. First of all, I objected, and you know how this case came before the court, and you know how the enhancement was raised at the last minute without any notice, and I went in there and I objected to what, you know, as best as I can discern was the direction the district court was trying to take. The resolution here, again, follows Ameline. I think it's footnote 14. The court attempted to base its determination using only a preponderance on the pre-sentence report. I objected to that at the time.
You did not object to the portions of the pre-sentencing report on which he relied to find that the victim was especially vulnerable.
Well,
her troubled childhood and so forth.
I didn't object to the comments contained in the pre-sentence report because they were so, in effect, relatively benign and ambiguous in terms of what, in fact, was the situation there. And the court relied on an extrapolation from those comments to a mental condition which was never discussed anywhere in the pre-sentence report. Ameline says in footnote 14, if the objection is made, then the pre-sentence report cannot alone constitute a basis for a determination. And what Mr. Garver would like to have this court do is find that the burden should have been proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The case should be remanded because a sentencing error took place with respect to the application of the guidelines within the context of the plea agreement. And we should have an entitlement to have the matter heard on an evidentiary basis as to whether or not...
You want a new sentencing with a beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Exactly. And I want to have...
So what we would be doing is issuing a mandate to the judge to resentence the defendant in violation of current law, applying the wrong standard.
Not at all, because there's nothing under current law that says that the parties cannot, in fact, negotiate and reach an accommodation with respect to the standard of proof that is applicable in the case that can be accepted by the court and applied. And as well, I would argue, and I think the court yourselves need to consider the ex post facto implications of the Booker remedial opinion.
What evidence did you introduce indicating that the victim was mature and intelligent?
I introduced I didn't introduce any evidence because the evidence was, in fact,
There was not any evidence, though.
Oh, yes, there was, Judge. There was a considerable amount of evidence concerning the minor's maturity.
In the course of the trial, there was a lot of evidence concerning her background.
There was evidence...
Is there anything else besides that at the sentencing hearing? Did you introduce anything else except what was introduced at the trial on the guilt phase?
When I came before the court for sentencing, on that morning, Judge, there was no indication whatsoever from any party, the government or the court.
My question has to deal only with facts.
The facts?
Now, there was no testimony whatsoever at the sentencing hearing by you or anybody else that she was mature and intelligent. And the only evidence before the judge was a probation report indicating that she was not mature and intelligent. Am I correct or not?
No, sir, you're incorrect. Because, number one, the probation report did not indicate that she was not mature and intelligent. In fact, the probation officer, a skilled probation officer, interviewed the minor, did not make any recommendation to the court concerning a vulnerable victim enhancement, did not make any suggestion to the court that she suffered from any mental infirmity whatsoever. And, sir, if I may, most importantly, the minor herself filed a victim impact statement with the court in which she said, "We made the decision together."
Yeah. The fact,
but she was legally incapable of making that decision.
That may be as a matter of the law in terms of her opportunity consent, and Mr. Garver was wrong in taking her, and he was punished by prosecution in federal and state court for that circumstance. That doesn't mean that as a matter of fact she was immature or she didn't have the capacity to make a decision, or that she was so infirm mentally as to qualify as being unusually vulnerable.
Thank you, counsel. We are way over time.
All right. Thank you.
Take notes anyway. We may give you 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Thanks.
Counsel, please proceed.
May it please the court. Greg Nyes for the United States.
Counsel, I have a question for you on the topic we've been discussing with opposing counsel. The citation to the Seventh Circuit case suggests that if the parties agree to a higher burden of proof on the government than is otherwise required, they can do that and they're bound by it. First of all, is that your reading of the Seventh Circuit case? And secondly, if it is, should we follow that line of thinking?
No, it's not the government's reading of that case. In that particular case, the court specifically found that the court below made specific errors in the calculation, which led to the defendant's sentencing level. And based on that error, the government then found that there had been a violation of the terms of the agreement.
You mean the court found?
Yes, I'm sorry. The court found that there was a violation of the terms of the agreement. But what we don't have here in front of us is the nature of that agreement.
There's some language quoted about beyond a reasonable doubt. Did the court tell the district court to use a beyond a reasonable doubt standard on remand?
In Berheide.
In Berheide?
Yes, it did. The court specifically vacated the sentence and remanded for sentencing under the sentencing guidelines as mandatory.
Okay. Well, let's
beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Did they say when they vacated the sentence and remanded it? I know they did that, and I know they said sentence according to the guidelines, and I know that under Booker the guidelines would be non-mandatory. What I want to know is when the court remanded in the Seventh Circuit in Berheide for new sentencing, did it tell the judge to use the preponderance of evidence standard that's ordinarily used under the guidelines or the beyond a reasonable doubt standard referred to by the plea agreement in that case?
It appears to be silent, Your Honor. It does not indicate what level of proof that the court below is to use.
It talked about what it had done but not what it was going to do on remand then?
Yes.
Okay. The underlying question, though, remains. If the government is willing to agree to a higher standard of proof than is otherwise required, why shouldn't we hold the government to that promise or bargain?
Well, specifically, Your Honor, the agreement that the defendant bargained for in its entirety was an agreement to make a recommendation to the court, and we agreed to utilize certain burdens along the way to that agreement.
But there's also a specific sentence, and you haven't really answered my question. I'm going to ask it again. The defendant consented to judicial fact-finding and the resolution of sentencing issues according to the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, and the parties agreed that the way they had calculated the baseline sentence were facts that could be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, depending on how we read that, that could be read as an agreement by the government also to prove the sentencing issues by that standard. There are really two issues. One is you're saying that's not really the government's agreement to do that, and I understand that. But let's assume we disagree with you and we read that as a government agreement to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Why shouldn't we hold the government to that?
Because the court has judicial discretion to either accept or reject the plea agreement in its entirety or portions of it. I understand the court's concern with the government coming back now and saying, no, the argument really should be at a preponderance level, or the proof should be at a preponderance level. The issue was we're operating under a different legal standard at that time. With the change in pre-Booker and post-Booker law, with the sentencing coming post-Booker, the court specifically found below that the court had judicial discretion to either accept or reject the agreement.
Yes, it did, but the part that gave the court discretion and says that the court can give you any sentence it chooses to. You're not going to necessarily get what we are recommending. That's true enough, but that doesn't really say by what standard additional facts have to be found.
If
the court has discretion to say 71 months instead of 30 months, but that doesn't really answer the question about how the government has to demonstrate that or by what standard the court has to find it.
I think that the district court, when it expressly rejected the terms of the plea agreement by its sentence, did so correctly, even though the government and the defense had argued, and I think the government argued even that the plea agreement should be followed at the district court level, even though there was an agreement to abide by the proof of beyond a reasonable doubt. The issue was, and Mr. Schatz did not quite get to that effect, but the plea agreement, the plea petition itself, at excerpt of record 5, I believe it is, states specifically that the defendant is entering an 11C1C plea, where the judge retains discretion.
Wait a minute.
Excuse me, C1B.
DR-5?
It's DR-5, paragraph 9, Your Honor. It states specifically, my plea of guilty is under 11C1B. Therefore, although the judge will consider my recommendations and agreements of both the prosecution and the defense, the judge is not obligated to follow those agreements or recommendations. So despite the agreement of the parties, the court was free to do what it pleased, as long as there was a sufficient basis of fact in the record. Therefore, if the court were to follow the holding in Berline, or I think that's how you say it, Berline, there would be a problem because you would be remanding the case with instructions to the district court to disregard the applicable law as it's currently set. Secondly, you would be ignoring the entirety of the plea agreement wherein it says this agreement gives the judge discretion and is really only a recommendation to the court for a particular sentence. And third, we don't have the plea agreement in Berline in front of us. We don't know, and the language in the opinion suggests that it might have been an 11C1C plea because the at 542, the opinion states, in this case, the government and Berhide entered into a plea agreement which was accepted by the court. And under an 11C1B plea, there is no requirement that the court accept the plea specifically before proceeding. Despite Mr. Schatz's protestations that the court accepted the plea, at the ER 41, the court specifically states that if I accept your plea, the agreement is a prediction or a recommendation. There are additional areas which should need to be addressed and the court needs to be aware of. The issues settled by United States versus DuPas and again in United States versus Dare have dispositively disposed of the remaining issues other than the plea agreement. If the court has no further questions for the government, I'll submit on the briefs.
Thank you. Kevin.
Thank you.
30 seconds.
Berhide is not 11C1C. It's clear from the opinion what happened there. The Seventh Circuit said that Mr. Berhide, based on his contract, was entitled to a properly calculated sentence under the mandatory guidelines. The district court, in fact, had applied the proof beyond reasonable doubt standard. Clearly, the Seventh Circuit was sending that case back down to the district court under the mandatory guidelines to use the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. With respect to the 11C1B, 11C1C issue, 11C1B makes certain recommendations to the court, but it is undeniable that in the record of this case, given its posture before the court, we reserved, and it's at page 40 of the excerpt of record, we have reserved the entitlement to have material facts pertinent to determination of any potential change in the range of imprisonment determined by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court said to Mr. Garber on that date, that's correct, sir.
Thank you, counsel. United States versus Garber is submitted.